Hi, friends. How are we doing? Thank you for coming to church today. Whether you're with us in person or online, we're thrilled you're part of what God's doing at Capital Church today. This morning, we continue a series we're calling Real. We're looking at the flawed but faith-filled journey of the disciple Peter. In this series, we're discovering Peter's not perfect. He's often impetuous and impulsive. He speaks before he thinks. He embraces fear over faith. Peter's clearly a person in process. And that's why so many followers of Jesus have found encouragement in his story. It's because his story sounds a lot like my story. Maybe it sounds like yours as well. But there's something about one's story. It's that everybody's story begins within someone else's story. And that's certainly true of Peter. So today, we're going to rewind in the story of Peter to the beginning of his story with Jesus, which starts with his brother Andrew's story with Jesus. Before I take you there, let's invite God to speak to us. Lord, may you help us to see a clear picture of the abundant life you've promised us in you. And God, I pray you give us passion to pursue you so we might become like you. Now, for my friends here who don't know you or don't know you well, may they too get a glimpse of the life that could be theirs in you. And Lord, in response, may they seek you and find you with us so we might experience that abundant life together. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Who has had the greatest influence on your life? I suppose I'd answer that question differently in different seasons. But when I consider the last 20 years of my life, three people come to mind. One is Henry Cloud. Now, I don't know him well. Though I've met Dr. Cloud on multiple occasions, we've had dinner once several years ago, but he's not my personal mentor. But an amazing psychologist, leadership consultant. I have, however, read his books. I've watched his lectures. Through Dr. Cloud, God has taught me countless truths about loving people and leading people. His wisdom has shaped my marriage and my family and my thoughts and my words and my decisions. That's why I'm constantly recommending books by Henry Cloud. He's written some of my favorite books on dating and parenting and leading and marriage. I write Henry a thank you note every single year because of his influence on me. I thank God for Dr. Cloud. Another major influence in my life is a man named Patrick Lencioni. Lencioni is a New York Times best-selling author and leadership consultant. He is a pioneer in the field of organizational management, particularly because of his work in organizational health. Lencioni's clients include 78 of the companies on the Fortune 100 list, including Amazon, Walmart, Southwest Airlines. But he also loves to coach nonprofits and pastors. His best-selling book is called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. We've worked through several of his books over the years as a staff at Capital, such as The Ideal Team Player and The Advantage, though we haven't tackled that book on the lower right called Getting Naked. It might be a bit suspect with a bunch of pastors walking around with a book called Getting Naked. Just like Dr. Cloud, I don't know Patrick personally. I've met him on four or five occasions, but we've never spent any real time together. I could never afford his consulting fee. However, just like Dr. Cloud, I send Patrick a thank you note every single year, because without ever coming to Capital Church, you will find his fingerprints all over our organization. But the greatest influence in my life is someone I've never even met. You know who it is? Any guesses? That's right, Ryan Seacrest. Actually, it is Dallas Willard. For decades, Dr. Willard served as the professor of philosophy at USC, but Dallas's primary influence extended to the church and to church leaders. And friends, you can track his influence on me in my messages. The only thing I share to you more than food photos are Dallas Willard quotations. Am I right? I've got a Dallas Willard quote for every occasion, such as, "Everything you can do with anger, you can do better without it." Dallas said, "You can't love in a hurry any more than you can sleep in a hurry." Here's one you may remember. Dallas said, "We are to see every event as an occasion in which the competence and faithfulness of God will be confirmed to us." He said, "Nothing irredeemable has happened to us or can happen to us on our way to our destiny. In God's full world, nothing irredeemable. God can redeem it all." Regarding discipleship to Jesus, Dallas wrote, "It is the responsibility of every Christian to carve out a satisfying life under the rule of God so that sin won't look so good." He said, "If our lives and works are to be of the kingdom of God, we must not have human approval as a primary or even major aim. We must lovingly allow people to think whatever they will." To church leaders, Dallas offered a suggestion which will go a long way to explain our church model to those from different traditions. Dallas said this. He said, "We should intend to make disciples, or we should intend to make disciples and let converts happen, rather than intending to make converts and letting disciples happen." In my experience, you get a very different result. This next quote shaped me more than most. "Don't trust your best. Do your best and trust God." On the subject of grace, Dr. Willard taught, "Grace is opposed to earning, not effort." Tim just told you our students are spending a whole weekend retreat talking about God's grace. Dallas explained, "Grace is God acting in your life to accomplish what you cannot." Well, friends, if that's true, then the true saint burns grace like a 747 burns fuel on takeoff. I got a Dallas Willard quote for every occasion. Just ask my children. I can be anywhere and pull one out in a meeting, at a stoplight, ordering a chicken biscuit at Chick-fil-A. Here are a few maybe you haven't heard. Dallas said, "People sometimes think it's a miracle that God loves them." No, God simply is love. It would take a miracle for God not to love somebody. Did anybody need to hear that today? Dallas used to say, "One of the hardest things in the world is to be right and not hurt anybody with it." He regularly argued, "There is no problem in human life that apprenticeship to Jesus cannot solve." He said, "Whomever really believes that will become his disciple without pastors having to pester them about it." Then he said, "Whomever doesn't really believe that will not become his disciple, no matter how much we pester them about it." Dallas observed, "The surest way to know what you haven't surrendered to God is to consider what you're worrying about." Oh my. He maintained, "God never gives anyone too much to do. We do that to ourselves or allow others to do it to us. However, when you have become convinced that the world is able to function without you, you will find true rest." Okay, just one more. "When the Lord is your shepherd, you are prepared to take the absence of something from your life as proof you don't need it." I never got to meet Dallas Willard before he passed away, but his teaching has shaped me. His writings have taught me how to love God and love others. And to this day, many of the people that Dallas discipled are some of my favorite writers, like John Ortberger and James Bryan Smith. Frankly, many of the people that Dallas discipled are some of my favorite people, period. Dallas Willard is by far the greatest influence on my life. I ponder his words because they make me better, they make my life better, they've led me to love and joy and peace and patience. But when I say that Dr. Willard is my greatest influence, I'm making an exception, a pretty significant exception, because really my greatest influence is King Jesus. More than any morsel of insight I've received from Willard or Cloud or Lencioni, I mull over and over the words and ways of Jesus. In fact, the reason Dallas's words are so potent is they were shaped by him mulling over and over the words and ways of Jesus. I think Henry Cloud and Patrick Lencioni would say the same thing. Patrick concludes one of his recent bestsellers pointing to the pristine example of King Jesus as a model for life and leadership. Imagine a bunch of business people reading that. Henry's latest book talks about his own struggle with sickness and suffering and depression, but then his encounter with Jesus, the great healer, who called Henry to be a healer of others too. And sure, I'll continually encourage you to read all these authors and more. But my friend, if you really want to know how to live, if you really want to know how to love, if you really want to know how to lead, dear me, start with Jesus. End with Jesus. Fill your days with Jesus. Fill your mind with Jesus. Because as influential as those three leaders have been in my life, they're not going to be there when I need them. Not really. See, Henry's not there to call balls and strikes when I'm engaged in a high stakes or emotionally charged conversation with Suzanne or my girls. Patrick's not there when I'm in a meeting and I'm bringing feedback or receiving feedback from one of my colleagues. They're not available to me. And even if they were my besties, they couldn't be what I truly need them to be. But friends, the opposite is true with Jesus. Jesus is not merely a teacher of timeless truths that he can that we can apply to our time in a timely manner. No, Jesus is God and King who has come in flesh and blood to make God knowable, personal, intimate, and daily, if we let him. Sure, I've become a disciple of Willard and Cloud and Lencioni, but how much more have I become a disciple of Jesus who trains and coaches and leads and chides? He offers real-time feedback and unconditional love. And not just in one or two areas of life. If I let him, his life and love will seep into every conversation, every decision, and every relationship. And not with guilt and shame, but always with grace and truth. How can you develop a connection to Jesus like that? Well, the theologian, humanitarian, physician Albert Schweitzer, who won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1952, devoted his busy life to the study of Jesus. And for those in our day wishing we could know Jesus like Dallas Willard knew Jesus, Schweitzer offered these encouraging words. He said, "Follow him and you'll know him. Follow him and you'll know him." A passage we're going to consider in John's gospel is going to show us how. And it'll show us how by introducing us to some of Jesus' first followers. See, there's something unique about John's gospel and the way he uses his words. He's more poetic than the other New Testament authors. His writing is rich in symbolism and imagery. And virtually every scholar who's written about John notes, John's writing about the first disciples serves as a paradigm for future disciples. We'll begin reading in verse 35 of John chapter 1. "The next day, John was there again with two of his disciples." Now, the John mentioned here is not our author, John. It's John the Baptist. John the Baptist is a teacher in his own right with disciples who follow him and learn from him. But John made clear to them he is not the teacher. He is not the master. His job is only to point to them. And John does exactly that in the next verse. "When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, 'Look, the Lamb of God.' Now, by calling Jesus the Lamb of God, he is identifying him as the Messiah, the anointed king who would serve his people and save his people by dying for his people, thus restoring them to life in God. John says, when the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Now, when our narrator says they followed Jesus, he doesn't mean they walked behind Jesus a bit. No, he meant they stopped being John's disciples and became Jesus' disciples. Now, we don't know how John feels about this, but we know what John thinks about this. This is all a part of the plan. John's job is to point people to the truth. Jesus is the truth. And maybe you're searching for truth. You long to make your life better. You long to make your life mean something. And you found truth along the way. But there's something you sense deep in your soul. What you found is not the whole truth. You still haven't found what you're looking for. Okay, I gotta wonder if the truth you have found ultimately is pointing you to the truth of Jesus. These disciples of John wondered if that were true, and they knew there was only one way to find out for sure. They made a decision to become students of Jesus, his apprentices. Now, I bet if we took a room full of churchgoers like this and asked, how many of you are Christians? All around America, I think the vast majority of people would raise their hands. But if I asked the same room a different question, how many of you are disciples of Jesus? We wouldn't get near as many hands. It's because of that word, disciple. Think about it. It's a strong word in our English language. It's one thing to be influenced by a musician. It's another thing to be a disciple of that musician. It's one thing to agree with the positions of a political candidate. It's another thing to be a disciple of that political candidate. Jesus calls his followers to be disciples. That word disciple is mentioned 269 times in the New Testament. The word Christian is mentioned 3 times. Now hear me, there's nothing wrong with the word Christian, but I think there's something in this word disciple that we're supposed to learn. Jesus calls his followers to be disciples. But you wouldn't necessarily know that by looking at his churches. We reserve the label disciple for the hardcore, the upper tier, the diehards. Almost as if discipleship were optional. But friends, that's simply not true. At the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus gives his followers a mission, saying, go into all the world and make disciples. He doesn't say make converts. He doesn't say get people to pray a prayer once. He says make disciples. And then he elaborates on it in verse 20 by describing them as people who learn to do everything he said to do. No wonder so few Christians experience the abundant life described by Jesus. We've got a bunch of undiscipled disciples. We got a bunch of followers of Jesus who aren't really following him. Oh, but friends, follow him and you'll know him. The model of disciple and rabbi in the first century was different than the model of student and teacher that we have today. See, students get information, disciples get transformation. Contemporary Christians often settle for learning what Jesus did and why Jesus did it. But disciples aren't satisfied to learn about Jesus. They want to become like Jesus. They want to know Jesus. That's what it means to be a disciple. A disciple is someone who's learning from Jesus personally how to do life. And hear me, you don't have to be perfect to be a disciple. You can be a beginner and call yourself a disciple. Please understand, it took Jesus' closest followers years to trust him completely with their lives. See, it's not about perfection, but it's about decision and intent. For my fellow Christians in the room, here's a crucial question. Have you committed yourself to learn how to live as an apprentice of Jesus? Or are you just looking for him to enhance what you've already got going? In first century Palestine, if you were a disciple, a Talmud in Hebrew, you'd follow your rabbi everywhere. Even when you weren't certain where he was going or why he was going there, you knew he had something he wanted you to learn, so you followed. As you followed your rabbi, you would emulate everything you saw. You'd hang on his every word. Now, this is still true today with Talmudim. Ray Vanderlaan, an American scholar who studied with Jews in Jerusalem, observes that Talmudim disciples will even follow their rabbi into the bathroom just in case their teacher breathes a prayer or shares a word of instruction in the bathroom. There's a saying about rabbis and disciples written about 100 years before the time of Jesus. Let your home be a meeting house for the sages. Cover yourself with the dust of their feet and drink in their words thirstily. Let's unpack this a bit. Open your home for the rabbi to teach. There are multiple examples of people doing this in the Gospels. Consider Martha and Mary in Luke chapter 10. They opened their home so Jesus could teach. Then consider Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus, drinking in his every word. That's the posture of a disciple. The saying continues, cover yourself with the dust of their feet. What does that mean? Well, the closest followers journeyed with their teacher, and that often meant a lot of traveling. Roads were generally unpaved in ancient Israel, so when you walked, you kicked up a lot of dust. After a day of travel, following your rabbi, you might literally be covered with the dust kicked up by his feet, if you're following close enough. Are you following the rabbi that close? So close that you're covered with his dust? You may not be. I've said to you many times, we're all at different places on the spiritual journey. You may not be right on his heels. Maybe you're trying to get closer to hear what he's saying, like the crowds who surrounded Jesus as he taught his disciples. Or maybe you've heard about Jesus and you're curious, so you're peeking over the fence, so to speak, as he passes by. Well, friends, we want Capital Church to be a safe place for all of you to discover what Jesus says. But know this. How close you follow him is up to you. This is my message to all of you, young or not so young, committed Christian or curious questioner. Wherever you are, whatever you do, learn from Jesus. How to be a better mother, how to be a better daughter, how to be a better leader. Learn from Jesus how to love people who are hard to love, how to trust God when things are lean, how to face the attack of your enemies and be able to sincerely pray, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is what John's two disciples intended to do. John 1:38, turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, what do you want? You have to put the inflection in the right places. What do you want? No. As our narrator puts to parchment this story of Jesus, he wants us to read Jesus' question on two levels. First, Jesus is asking the disciples of John about their intention in following him. Second, he's asking us about our intentions. What do you want? What are you seeking in your pursuit of spiritual truth? Maybe you want your problem solved. Maybe you want your body healed. Maybe you want to find love. You know, most of us just want peace. You may know it by the Hebrew word shalom. It means well-being, satisfaction, fulfillment, completion. Shalom is a state of wholeness. It's a rich fullness in every area of life, your career, your religion, your relationships. Now, whether you call it shalom or not, it's really what every human being is chasing. Whether you hope to find shalom in success or marriage or divorce or the approval of a VIP in your life, the thing you're actually chasing is probably shalom. Jesus asks these two disciples of John, what do you want? The former disciples of John don't answer him outright. They respond to his question with a question. They said, Rabbi, which means teacher, where are you staying? Now, they're not dodging the question. Their answer to his question is revealed in their question. They want to be with Jesus. By referring to him as a rabbi, their intention is all the more clarified. Regarding discipleship, Dallas believed, if I'm to be someone's apprentice or disciple, there is one absolutely essential condition. I must be with that person. Now, if you find yourself asking, what would it look like for me to be with Jesus as a disciple today? You're asking the right question. Because if you follow him, you'll know him. The two would-be disciples ask, teacher, where are you staying? Jesus replies, come, and you will see. Just like the other verses, John intends us to read this verse on two levels. On one level, Jesus invites the disciples to see where he lives. On the other, Jesus invites us to see who he is. That's his invitation to you. Maybe you're wondering if there's a God. Maybe you're wondering if there's any truth in the life and teaching of Jesus. Well, he is inviting you to come and see. He offers the same invitation to all would-be or longtime disciples of Jesus. This includes everyone from the novice to the veteran. Come and see. Maybe you're new to a journey of faith. Maybe you came today and you're curious, but you're not ready to commit. You're not ready to embrace discipleship. Look, I understand. Maybe you need to get to know Jesus first. That's wise. Well, follow him and you'll know him. Remember, a follower or disciple of Jesus is someone who's learning from him how to do life. Well, here's my advice. Put his words into practice and watch what happens. Look, I'm not going to ask you to take my word for it. And I'm certainly not going to ask you to put my words into practice. I'm going to ask you to put his words into practice and find out for yourself. Experiment with the teaching of Jesus. As I said a few weeks ago, do what he says and see what he does. If you don't know what he says, find out. Put his words into practice and watch what happens in your life. Watch what happens in the world around you. Make it a goal of this season to discover and do everything he invites his followers to do. Then see for yourself if he's the way, the truth, and the life. Our narrator John tells us they went and saw where he was staying, and they spent the day with him. It was about 4 PM. Some scholars think the lateness of the hour implies it would be too late for the disciples to journey by foot to their homes. So they stay the night, likely, probably talking through the night with Jesus. Wouldn't you like to have eavesdropped on that conversation? We don't know what they learned, but we know how one of the disciples responded. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said. And who had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, we have found the Messiah. That is the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. Friends, this actually is the beginning of Simon Peter's connection to Jesus. Now, I'm sure Andrew was influenced by John the Baptist. But it certainly didn't take long to convince him about the nature and the calling of King Jesus. He said to his brother, Simon Peter, whose story we're studying, Simon, we found the King, the Messiah, the Christ. Now, friends, Andrew's experience is my experience, personally and pastorally. It doesn't usually take long If someone intently pursues Jesus, if they take his teaching seriously with a sincere heart and an open mind and begin to engage him in prayerful dialogue, it doesn't usually take long for them to discover for themselves who he really is. That's because if you follow him, you'll know him. If you follow him, you'll know him. Jesus looked at him, meaning Peter. And that word looked in Greek is a very intense word. He looked intently at Peter. He looked through Peter. He looked in Peter and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas," which when translated is Peter. Now, Cephas means rock. He says, "You will be called the rock." How many of you just pictured the action adventure movie star? Well, the rock isn't his given name either. It's Dwayne. Jesus' nickname for Peter proves prophetic, though not right away. The irony is not lost on us. Peter is the furthest thing from a rock in the gospel narratives. He's wobbly, he's shaky, faithful one minute, faithless in the next. But when Jesus looks at Peter, he sees right through him and to his future. Yes, when we follow Jesus, we come to know Jesus. But when we follow Jesus, we also come to know ourselves. Our true selves, who we're called to be, how we're called to live. And Jesus has a funny way of calling that out in us and bringing it to life. Oh, wouldn't you like to hear what he said to Peter next? We'd love to know what he said to Peter. We'd love to know what he said to Andrew. But you don't need to know what he said to either of them. You just need to know what he's saying to you. Well, the only way to find out is by following him, so you'll know him. Now, what you'll come to know about him is Jesus is no taskmaster. He's a teacher, but he's more than a teacher. He is a gentle guide on this journey who offers this invitation. Jesus says in Matthew 11, verse 28, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." First, Jesus offers this invitation, but friends, it's on you to respond. He welcomes you with open arms. Will you walk toward him and with him? And look who he invites. All who are weary and burdened. The word weary in Matthew's original Greek language means working to the point of exhaustion. Are any of you tired today? You work, you run, you give, you go, but in the end, you feel like you're just spinning your wheels. If that's you, Jesus says, "You're just the person I'm looking for. Come, you'll find rest." He says, "Come to me, all who are burdened." Sometimes it's translated heavy laden. It means to be weighed down by a heavy load. Metaphorically speaking, burdens are the shoulds of the world. Expectations, pressure, stress imposed by another. What are some of the shoulds you've been bearing lately? Maybe you've been burdened by religion. Life is hard enough as it is, but legalistic religion can be an indescribable weight, and legalistic religion can turn rest into weariness. Maybe you're wearied by a religion that doesn't work but requires you to work. But that's when religion becomes merely a list of do's and don'ts, when religion asks much but gives little and holds us to a high standard that seems impossible to reach. That then you live life with a nagging sense of guilt that convinces you will never be good enough. Your soul may be steeping in a sour solution of religious legalism right now, and that shame has begun to saturate your entire life. And my dear friend, if that is you, Jesus says, "Come to me and I'll give you rest." Maybe you want to please God, but you can't. You know you should forgive your dad, but your heart's stone cold toward him. You want to watch your mouth, but your tongue is so sharp. You want to be a patient mom or a patient manager, but you can't seem to do it, and you're exhausting your soul trying. Look, if that's you, let me tell you about my rabbi who says, come to me and I will give you rest. You know, there's another word that leaps off the page to me from this passage. It's the word all. All is a marker of his grace. And all is an utterly inclusive word. Troy, but what if I've sinned? What if I'm a hypocrite? What if I'm a stubborn, insolent child who can't take God at his word, though he's proven himself to be faithful again and again and again? Well, Jesus says, all. I bet that includes you. Then he invites us, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. Now, a yoke is a wooden frame that's stretched across the back of a couple animals. It enables them to pull heavy loads or plow a field. Question. Why would Jesus use this language about his teaching if his end game is rest? Why offer a yoke? Well, in the ancient world, rabbis had their own interpretations of the Torah or the law of God. See, there were different schools of rabbis who embraced different interpretations or applications of the law as they applied their teaching to everyday life. For example, consider the commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, one rabbi may come along and interpret that to mean, you should offer to plow your neighbor's driveway while he's on vacation. Love your neighbor as yourself. Another rabbi may come along, yes, plow his driveway, but you must also check his mail. Love your neighbor as yourself. A third rabbi may argue, no, it is not necessary to plow his driveway, but you should check his mail and pay his bills. Love your neighbor as yourself. Well, by the time of the first century, a rabbi's interpretation of the Torah, or the law of God, became known as his yoke. If you or I were to become a disciple of a rabbi, we would take on the yoke of that rabbi or his particular understanding of God's teaching. So when Jesus says, take my yoke upon you, he is saying, friends, trust me for my interpretation of God's teaching. New Testament scholar Dale Bruner commented, a yoke is a work instrument. Thus, when Jesus offers a yoke, he offers what we think tired workers need least. They need a mattress or a vacation, not a yoke. But Jesus realizes that the most restful gift he can give the tired is a new way to carry life, a fresh way to bear responsibility. Jesus says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Jesus says, if you adopt my way of living, you will find rest for your soul. Not just a good night's sleep or even a cruise on the Mediterranean. If you follow my teaching, you will find rest at the very core of your being. Doesn't that sound powerful? Doesn't that sound wonderful? Look, it's at least worth looking into, right? Jesus explains, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, this does not mean Jesus lowers the standards. No, in some way, Jesus actually raises the bar. The law of God said, don't commit adultery. Jesus says, don't lust. To be clear, Jesus doesn't make his yoke easier by relaxing the standards of righteousness. No, Jesus offers relationship through which we find the power to live righteously. You see, he bears the yoke with us. And let's make no mistake about who's doing the heavy lifting in the relationship, okay? Look, if you're anything like me, not a day goes by when you don't realize you will never hit the mark on your own. You'll never make it over the bar. Maybe you're weary and burdened because of your failure. Your failure as a father, as a mother, as a friend, as a spouse. How about trying on a different yoke? How about spending less time trying to change and more time asking Jesus to change you. Oh, if only you could grasp the lavish love of God, who wants you to change, forgives your failure to change, then helps you to change. I'm telling you, let Jesus form you, not just inform you. But to do so, my friend, you have got to come to him. You've got to take up his yoke and learn from him. And that means you got to follow him so you can know him. How? Well, clearly, there is a difference between following Jesus in the first century and following Jesus today. In those days, Peter, James, John, and Mary left families and careers behind to literally follow Jesus wherever he went. But Jesus isn't with us in the same way he was with Peter, James, John, and Mary. Though he's with us in a way that he can be with all of us at once. Here's the theological explanation. Jesus died on the cross for the sins of the world so we might be reconciled to God. He rose from the dead, ascended into heaven, and sent his Spirit to all of us who trust him. And it's through his Spirit that he loves us and leads us. No, we can't follow Jesus the same way that Peter, James, and John and Mary followed him. Today our habits changed a little, but the heart remains the same. It's a desire to hang on his every word and imitate what we see him doing. And the essential component of discipleship is just as true today as it was 2,000 years ago. If I am going to be someone's disciple, then I have to be with that person. So my question to you is this: what are you doing to be with Jesus as you journey? You've got to come to him. You've got to learn from him. What practices have you put in place to connect with Jesus this coming week? Now, friends, normally at this point of the message, I'd close in prayer. And I will pray. But first, I want to jump ahead and give you a little homework. And I'm going to offer different assignments to different people at different places on the spiritual journey. First, if you're seeking, if you're searching, if you're curious, I'm going to invite you to simply pray an honest prayer to begin the conversation with Jesus. Here's what I mean. You just sit with him a moment and you say, Jesus, if you're real, now, but do you see the honest part? That kind of honesty won't offend him. And if you don't know he's real, pray like that. And remember, worst case scenario, you're talking to yourself. You've probably done dumber things than that this week, right? Jesus, if you're real, I want to know you. I want to learn from you. Maybe you want to even go so far as to say, I want to follow you. Will you teach me? I'd like to see if your way's better. Make it your own prayer. It's better if you say it in your own words. Because your heart's what matters, not the words. You don't need to pepper the prayer with a bunch of these and thous. That's not interesting to God. You be you. You're coming to know him. So pray that honest prayer to begin a conversation with him. And for all of you, no matter where you are in the journey of faith, here's what I'm going to challenge you to do. Read the Gospels of Jesus. Now, these are the first four books of the New Testament: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Read and reread the Gospels of Jesus. Now, you might want to, some of you are just quick readers and you want to power through them, rock on. My personal preference is quality over quantity. Take your time if you can. But when I ask you to read the Gospels of Jesus, that's how you're going to hear about his story. It's how you're going to hear about his teaching. But I want to go further than that with this assignment. I want you to read the Gospels of Jesus with Jesus. See? Over the last week or so, I reread Dallas Willard's biography. He didn't write it. A dear friend named Gary Moon wrote it, and it's called Becoming Dallas Willard. And it's a powerful little book. I like that it's called Becoming Dallas Willard, because Dallas Willard wasn't always Dallas Willard. You know what I mean when I say that? But as I read through that book again and hearing Dallas's story, I wasn't able to read it with Dallas. But I was able to read it with Jesus and talk to Jesus as I read Dallas's biography. Okay, why not read Jesus' biography with Jesus? That's what I'm asking you to do. And here's how this might work. Okay, don't overthink this. Just be you. Trust his grace and lean in and just say, before you start reading, Jesus, I want to know you. Would you reveal yourself to me through this book today? And just read a little. And if you feel a little tug at your heart, a little poke, don't shove it under the rug. Engage. You want to engage your soul, but I encourage you to engage your soul with Jesus. Say, God, what is that? What's going on right there? Why does that bug me? Invite him into the process. Here's how you'll know if it's him speaking to you. If it's shame, that ain't him. You hear me? Look at the banners behind me. He's a God of compassion and grace. He's slow to anger, and he is abounding in love. All right? If you feel shame as you think about these things, that's not him. That might be your voice. That might be the voice of an old church leader. That might be a voice of a mom or dad. I don't know whose voice that is. But it ain't him. He has a very different tone to his voice. You'll get to know what I mean as you get to know him. You'll see. But take my word for it for the moment. Read the Gospels with Jesus. See what he teaches you. And then, while you're at it, put his words into practice and watch what happens. Just try it. And do it in conversation with him. Okay. You talk about having compassion on people. I am unbelievably annoyed with this person in front of me right now. But I'm going to do it your way. Let's see how it goes. Help me, please. Right? Put his words into practice and see what happens, okay? Here's a book for you. It's called Practicing the Way by John Mark Comer. I mean, all last fall, I recommended this book on an almost weekly basis, especially when we were doing that series on spiritual formation through the fall. I'm recommending it to you again. It's probably the best book I've read in years, certainly on the subject of spiritual formation, because it distills down this idea of what it means to follow Jesus. And frankly, the entire first section, okay, it's be with Jesus so we become like Jesus so we can do what he did. Those are the three sections. That first section, be with Jesus, is what we just talked about today. And in this very practical book, John Mark Comer shows us the way and gives us some ideas of how we can be with Jesus today. All right? I encourage you strongly, pick up this book digitally. You can get it on audio, but read it with Jesus. Would you do that? Remember, you're not going to read it with John Mark Comer. Don't talk to him. That's weird. He lives in LA. He can't hear you. But you can talk to Jesus. Okay? You can talk to Jesus. One final thing I want you to do. Don't follow him alone. Don't follow Jesus alone. Remember the pattern in the Gospels. No one learned from Jesus alone. Everybody had a buddy. Okay? One of the key things we see in the first chapter of John's Gospel is the communal nature of faith. Read the rest of chapter 1 and you'll see what I'm talking about. The mutual endeavor of investigation, the shared experience of discovery. Often, our 21st century Western way of thinking concludes religion is private, religion is personal. What I believe about God is between me and God, if there is a God. Well, what we find in reading John's writing is while there is a powerful personal dimension to a journey of faith, no one takes the journey by themselves. So I'm going to encourage you over time to cultivate spiritual friendship in your life. Here's my recommendation. Journey with somebody a couple steps ahead of you. Journey with somebody a couple steps behind you. We're all in this together. It's like High School Musical. Just like High School Musical. Just, yeah. here's something you could do. I mean, first of all, if you want to, you might want to join one of our small groups. And you could fill out a connection card and do that. You can send us an email, smallgroups@capitalchurch.com. We'd love to get you connected to a small group. Some of you have done, you've taken that practicing the way, I don't know how many small groups we've had in our church who have worked through the books, practicing the way with John Mark Comer. A lot of you did it last fall. If you haven't done it, you should do it. Now you could do that formally. You can send us an email, smallgroups@capitalchurch.com. We'll resource you. We'll help you do that. We'll give you some ideas about how you might do that and gather some people around you. Maybe we'll help send some people your way if you'd like. Okay? And that's one way you could do it. Another way you could do it is just informally, like off the grid, gather some friends together and work through that book. Now, there's actually a video curriculum that you can use to work through the book. I haven't worked through it that way personally. I hear it's wonderful. I trust John Mark Comer. I bet it's wonderful. And so some of you might want to work through the video curriculum together as a group. Another way you can do it, all right, and again, this is kind of down and dirty, but for those of you here in the room, in the seat backs in front of you, see those message note cards, right, that Mackenzie will talk about in our announcements. If you turn that thing over, you'll see these four questions. Now, these four questions we use in our sermon-based small groups, because we have a lot of small groups in our church that when they get together, they're not necessarily studying the book of the Bible or another book. They're actually just coming together to talk about the message we just heard on the weekend. And so when they meet on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday through the week, they'll come together and they'll have these four questions ready. And the four questions are, what did you learn? What surprised you? What bothered you? What resonated with you? And that's kind of the outline of every sermon-based small group. By the way, you want to participate in one of those? Pull out that card, scan the QR code, we'll get you right in, okay? But what you may want to do is take those four questions and just work section by section through John Mark Comer's book too. That's how we did it as a church staff last year. We broke it up into, I think, five staff meetings over a period of months, and we used those four questions as a guide. We'd read the first section, and everybody would come in with responses to those four questions. And I'll tell you, they were some of the most invigorating staff meetings we've had. Like, we didn't want to stop meeting, and they went on way too long, and it's like 2-3 hours in, and I'm like, guys, I gotta go. And people want to keep talking, okay? Well, that's the beauty of a book like this, okay? So get connected. Don't follow Jesus alone. We can help if you want. smallgroups@capitalchurch.com. Scan that QR code. Something. Everybody good? Go to the Capital Church app. What else do I need to tell him, Kim? I can tell him all kinds of things. You can go talk to my friend Kim, who's right here in the front. And she'll get you connected too, okay? Now, may I pray for you? Father, I pray for my friends as they consider their own spiritual journeys. By your grace, may you inspire them to chase after you with all their hearts. Would you help them to identify simple practices they can use to connect with you each day so they might know you more and you might work in them and through them in powerful ways? I pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. Stand with me. Here's the verse for the week, friends. We worked through it just a moment ago. Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. That beautiful image that's on your screen will upload to our website and to our social media accounts, so be watching for them. You can download that, put it on your phone. I have this big TV in my office. Often this just lives there as a reminder for me to come to him. Remember, coming to Jesus is not something you do once. It's something you do a lot. A lot through the day is what helps me. So come to him, dear friends. Use this image as a tool if it will help. That image and the graphic I've been showing you throughout the message will both be available to download if you'd like them, okay? If you'd like to receive prayer, there will be someone here at the front to pray for you. If you're here in the room, you can also fill out a prayer request card in the seat back and drop it off in a drop box before you go. And whether you're here in person or if you're joining us online, send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com. We got a team of people, including me, who love to pray over your needs. So please send us your prayer requests, okay? This is what I want to pray for all of you. I'll keep it simple. And the words of Dr. Schweitzer, may you follow him so you'll know him. Thanks for coming to church today. Grace and peace.